Hi, I'm David Fettis, and welcome to part three of our look at economy in the introduction to sociology. Socialism refers to various theories of economic organization advocating public or direct worker ownership and administration of the means of production and allocation of resources, and a society characterized by equal access to resources for all individuals with a method of compensation based on the amount of labor expended. That's a mouthful. Basically, it's saying that everybody is going to be equal, and that everybody is going to own everything. Another way of saying that is nobody owns anything, but everybody owns everything. They own the means of production, they own the resources, and then the society makes sure everybody has equal access to all of that. That's the ideal of socialism, is that everybody has equal access to everything, and what they get is based on the exact amount of work that they put into it. Most socialists think that capitalism unfairly concentrates power and wealth among a small segment of society that controls capital and gets rich through exploitation, creates an unequal society, and does not use technology and resources to their maximum potential or in the interests of the public. So they just criticize capitalism for being unequal, not caring about what happens to the public, and exploiting people. All of their riches are just based on exploitation of others. Following Adam Smith, Karl Marx, in the 1800s, distinguished the use value of commodities from their exchange value in the market. Capital, according to Marx, is created with the purchase of commodities for the purpose of creating new commodities with an exchange value higher than the sum of the original purchases. So in other words, the stuff you bought to make a product, then you add all that together, and when you sell the product, you want that amount to be higher than the sum of the original purchases. And Marx is right that capital is created when you're selling stuff for more than you had to put into it. For Marx, the use of labor power had itself become a commodity under capitalism. It's just one more cost. You buy this, that, and the other thing, and then you buy the work to put it all together to make the product. And the exchange value of labor power, as reflected in the wage, is less than the value it produces for the capitalist. This difference constitutes surplus value, which capitalists extract and accumulate. Extraction of surplus value from workers is called exploitation. So the basic picture is, if you have a business enterprise and they have to spend a certain amount on the raw materials to make things and on the equipment to make it, and then a certain amount on the laborers, then what the laborers do is adding value, but then when they sell the stuff, they're selling it for more than what they paid for all the materials and what they paid to their laborers, and that excess is surplus value, and that's exploitation, because all of that surplus value should be going back to the workers, because they're the ones who created the surplus value, according to Marx's view. In his book Capital, Marx argues that the capitalist mode of production is distinguished by how the owners of capital extract this surplus from workers. All prior class societies had extracted surplus labor. They just made you work and work and work and work and work. And they got their money from you by making you work too hard. But capitalism was new in getting surplus value by the sale value of produced commodities. So they weren't necessarily making you work more hours or work you till you dropped, but they're getting the surplus value by selling it for more than they had to pay you. And so they're getting surplus value by getting money that's more than the wage they paid. Earlier societies just, they would make you work harder and pay you less because you were a slave anyway. Marx argued that a core requirement of a capitalist society is that a large portion of the population must not possess sources of self-sustenance that would allow them to be independent, and must instead be compelled, in order to survive, to sell their labor for a living wage. If they want to eat, they got to work. Marx didn't necessarily like that. So he wanted everybody to be self self-sufficient, or if they weren't self-sufficient, he says that's what you need in a capitalist society for it to work, is people who've got to work in order to make a living. Well, yeah, but he called that wage slavery. The Bible said if you don't work, you don't eat. But he called it wage slavery if you've got to earn wages in order to live. Marx said that exploited labor would be the driving force behind a revolution to a socialist-style economy. For Marx, this cycle of the extraction of the surplus value by the bourgeoisie, the fat cats, the owners of capital, becomes the basis of class struggle. This argument is intertwined with Marx's version of the labor theory of value, asserting that labor is the source of all value and thus of profit. That's questionable. Is labor the source of all value? What about those who invest in the enterprise in the first place and risk their money to make it go? What about those who didn't have necessarily that much more sweat they put into it, but their genius is what created value? Who creates the value of a smartphone? The person who helped put a few things together, or those who invented computing and chips and the like in the first place? Did all the value just come from the labor, or did it also come from the inventiveness and from the risk-taking of others? I'm not saying that labor has no value. Far from it. Labor has huge value. But Marx's theory that the only thing that adds value to a product is the work that was put into it is just obviously false. Because back in the day, there were people who worked super hard on some products that were not worth nearly what it is now. It might take more work to build a cart than to build a car nowadays with the use of robots and all of that, as well as the people who work on them. But the car is worth more than the cart. And the difference is not the amount of sweat that was put into it, but the inventiveness that was accumulated. Anyway, here's the Marxist picture of capitalist product, of capitalist profit. You have an entrepreneur, he's got the capital and the money, he puts that into a factory, means of production, and you add that means of production together with the workers, and you make a product. And then he sells it at a profit and pockets the money. And Marx calls that exploitation if you actually make money in business, because the only real value of the product is what the workers did. And so if you're making any profit at all, you're exploiting those workers, according to Marx. Here's the ideal picture of socialism. Government controls everything. And in this wise and benevolent government deals with people fairly. And so all the goods that workers earn go to the government. And then the government wisely redistributes those goods back to the workers as they have need. And the government decides what are the wants, the needs, the resources, the people, the competition. The government just determines and decides all of that. And then it dictates to the factory how many widgets it should make, how many phones it should make. It dictates to the farmers how many gallons of milk they should produce. It dictates everything. And then that, together with the workers, decides how things are produced. So it's very rational. Some big brains in the government are figuring out what everybody needs. And they're figuring out whatever, all that needs to be produced. And it is going to work out so that everybody's equal. Everybody produces, everybody gets back exactly what they need, and the government manages it all with perfect rationality and wisdom. Economists such as Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman said that socialist planned economies would fail because planners couldn't have the business information inherent to a market economy. The planners just wouldn't know what the real demand was if there was no opportunity for people to pay prices or to set prices or for companies to make a certain amount of a product. The government just wouldn't be able to figure all that out, said Hayek and Friedman. Nor could managers in a Soviet-style socialist economy match the motivation of profit. How do you tell people and force them to invest in things if they're never allowed to make a profit? And this critique turned out to be accurate. Soviet central planning could not figure out. Sometimes it produced way too much of something, sometimes not nearly enough of something, and workers became less and less motivated because they weren't going to profit anymore by working harder. Everybody gets the same thing. And so that did not give any incentive to work harder or to develop any initiative on your own or to invent things, because whatever you do, the government takes it and gives it to somebody else. In Western Europe, especially in the period after World War II, many socialist parties in government implemented what became known as mixed economies. And these governments nationalized some major industries while permitting a free market to continue in the rest. So parts of the economy were government-run, parts of the economy were still pretty much free enterprise and capitalism. These were most often, the ones that were nationalized, were often monopolistic or infrastructure industries like the mail, or railways, or power and other utilities. And typically, when these things were taken over by the government, it was achieved through compulsory purchases of the industry. So you had to sell it to the government, and you had to sell it pretty much at the price the government was offering, or they would just take it away, but at least you got something out of it. So in some communist economies, they just took the land away from the farmers, they took the money away from they just took everything. In the mixed economies, they only took certain industries from companies when they nationalized them, and then they paid the shareholders of those industries something. How did socialism get going? Well, Marxist and non-Marxist social theorists agree on something. They agree that socialism developed in reaction to modern industrial capitalism. There were some things badly wrong with industrial capitalism. There was exploitation of workers, no doubt about it, bad working conditions, too low a pay, some people with vast wealth, others with almost nothing. So it developed in reaction to some of the things that had gone wrong in industrial capitalism, but they disagree on the nature of their relationship. Emil Durkheim posits that socialism is rooted in the desire to bring the state closer to the realm of individual activity. So the government is standing up for the little guy. The corporations and the companies are bad, and the government is on the side of the people. So there's just a sense that the people are closer to the government, and the government is closer to the needs of their people. And this was something that appealed to people about socialism as presented in theory. In socialism, Max Weber saw acceleration of the rationalization started in capitalism. He said, if you think capitalism is rationalizing everything and controlling everything and concentrating everything into the power of a few hands, just wait till you see what socialism does. As a critic of socialism, he warned that placing the economy entirely in the state's bureaucratic control would result in an iron cage of future bondage. If you don't like it that a bunch of corporations have concentrated power, why would you want all the power to be concentrated in one entity, namely the government? If you think it's bad that that some corrupt people might exploit their power and their control of economic things, how can you trust the government to do a better job? That would just be an iron cage, says Weber. Social Democrats aren't complete socialists, and they believe in the rights of people to vote. Sometimes the communists didn't allow very much of that. But anyway, social democrats propose selective nationalization of key national industries in mixed economies while maintaining private ownership of capital and private business enterprise. So again, that's a mixed economy that the social democrats favor. Social democrats also promote tax-funded welfare programs and regulation of markets. And in a sense, it might be safe to say we're all social democrats to some degree, and that almost all the major economies of the modernized nations of the world are mixed economies where there is some private ownership and enterprise, and there's also a major component of nationalization of key elements of industry and regulation of nearly everything. So the question isn't whether there's a mixed economy and whether some degree of social democratic thinking is involved, it's just how far it goes. How far does the pendulum swing between private ownership and free enterprise versus public ownership and regulation? There's going to be differences, but all the economies are mixed economies. Many social democrats, especially in European welfare states, call themselves socialists, and they use the term differently from its original meaning. Unlike Marxist socialists, Social Democrats don't call for revolution or total abolition of private property. They favor a mixed economy, a blend of capitalism and socialism. But usually when they call themselves Social Democrats or even call themselves socialists, they're basically saying they want it to be more socialistic than it is, but not completely socialistic. Criticisms of socialism range from claims that socialist economic and political models are inefficient or incompatible with civil liberties, to condemnation of specific socialist states, such as brutal dictatorships and failed economies in the Soviet bloc, China, Cambodia, North Korea, Venezuela, a very long list of brutal dictatorships and messed up economies where socialism had its way completely. So there's the criticism that nobody among the central planners is going to be able to do this efficiently, and they're not going to be able to do it while preserving freedoms. Because when you take all of people's money, they don't have any freedom to determine how they spend it. When you tell them where they have to work or where they can't work, when it's a centrally managed economy, then freedom suffers, and not to mention, of course, what the impact was on religious freedom, because along with Marx's political theories, don't forget he had a religious theory, religion's the opiate of the people, and he had war on drugs. His war on drugs was a war on religion, the drug of the people. And so the Soviets, the Chinese, the Cambodians, the North Koreans, many of the communist countries of the 1900s, and some of them still today, have a war on religion. And that's another criticism of socialism as it's largely been practiced, because they were not only socialists economically, but they were atheists religiously and used government, as socialists love government. They trust government to do the will of the people. And the will of the whole people means that individual people can't follow their own religious convictions. Another criticism of socialism came from Friedrich Hayek. He argued that a socialist command economy couldn't adequately transmit information about prices and productive quotas due to the lack of a price mechanism. How much stuff do you make? Who knows how much stuff you should make until you start making it and start trying to sell it? But a government that's going to try to figure that all out in advance, Hayek says, can't be done. And as a result, the government couldn't make rational economic decisions. Hayek further argued that social control over distribution of wealth and private property advocated by socialists can't be achieved without reducing prosperity by the general populace and a loss of political and economic freedoms. So, you just can't have socialism, complete socialism, without everybody getting poorer and everybody losing freedom. That was Hayek's criticism. Ludwig von Mises argued that a socialist economy was not possible at all. He said, it's impossible. Because of the impossibility of rational pricing of capital goods in a socialist economy, since the state is the only owner of the capital goods. If the state only owns everything and it dictates everything, then how do you determine a fair price? You can't, because you don't know what the demand is. You have no way of measuring that if you already have it all as a government and control it all. Socialism failed as an economic system again and again and again wherever it was tried. Mixed economies, which involved a little bit of socialism mixed with a market economy, have been more successful. But socialism as just abolition of private property, government ownership of everything, that has failed miserably. Winston Churchill said, capitalism is the unequal distribution of blessing. Socialism is the equal distribution of misery. So, sure, nobody denies that there's inequalities in capitalism. And whether those inequalities are unjust, that's still a question, because some people do work harder than others. Some people exercise talent more than others do, or contribute more to the welfare of others than another person might. So is it unfair when there's inequality? If somebody works twice as hard as another and gets twice as rich, is that unfair because there was an unequal result? Well, maybe. And there are unjust inequalities, no doubt about it. But sometimes there are just inequalities as well. But the point stands. Churchill says capitalism, sure, there's inequality. It's unequal distribution of blessing. And socialism is the equal distribution of misery. Margaret Thatcher, another prime minister of Britain, said, the trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. Because socialism is always taking somebody else's money and giving it to others. That's the whole principle of it. And Margaret Thatcher says, after a while, the people who are productive, they just get sick of doing that. And you run out of other people's money. And in a mixed economy, too, there's an equilibrium where there's a certain amount of welfare, a certain amount of taxation that can be done to help those who are in need. But if tax levels get too high, people stop investing and people stop working if all of their earnings are taken away. And then you run out of other people's money and socialism collapses. Well, enough about socialism. Just a few more odds and ends of terms that are used in sociology. The gross domestic product, or GDP, of a country is a measure of the size of its economy. While it's often a useful number, it's also noted that GDP only includes economic activity for which money is exchanged. There's a lot that goes on that nobody gets paid to do. Many parents do stuff that's extremely valuable and don't get paid for it. And I could give many other examples. GDP and GDP per capita or per person are widely used indicators of a country's wealth. So the United States has the highest GDP in the world, and so it's considered the wealthiest nation in the world. The GDP per capita would mean that maybe another nation has a higher GDP per citizen, and so that might be the highest GDP per capita in the world. And here's just a picture of GDP of which nations have the largest gross domestic product. And this does not mean that the citizens of these nations are necessarily richer than those of others, though that may be the case. But Canada, for instance, has a much lower GDP than the United States, not because all Canadians are poorer than all Americans, but because the United States just plain has 10 times the size of the population and just more production in all things. But Canada, per person, may be doing just as well as the United States. But anyway, here's the heavy hitters, the big domestic product, and then those who have lower domestic product of the various nations. The Gini coefficient is a statistical measure of a country's income inequality. A Gini coefficient of 0 expresses perfect equality. There's no difference between the people of a society. They all have the same income. A Gini coefficient of 1 or 100% means there's maximal inequality. It goes from 0 to 100, where only one person has all the income and nobody else has anything. Some studies have suggested that greater income equality leads to poorer health. And certainly that's the case when there's just extremes of income inequality, where some people have next to nothing and other people have nearly everything. Then the people who have nothing are going to have poorer nutrition, poorer health care. An informal economy is economic activity that's neither taxed nor monitored by a government and is contrasted with the formal economy as described above. So you have the formal economy, but the informal economy isn't included in a government's GNP because it's just not measured. It's done kind of under the radar. Although the informal economy is often associated with developing countries, all economic systems contain an informal economy in some proportion. Informal economic activity is a dynamic process which includes many aspects of economic and social theory, including exchange, regulation, and enforcement. By its nature, it's difficult to observe or study or measure, so sociologists have a little harder time with the informal economy. Because the terms under the table and off the books typically refer to this type of economy. Black market refers to a subset of the informal economy. And examples of informal economic activity include the sale of illegal drugs and unreported payments for house cleaning or babysitting or just work that you do on the side and that you didn't report to the government. So there's a lot of things that go on that aren't reported to government. That's the informal economy. And then it also includes not just stuff that you got paid for and didn't report, but it also includes just things that you do that you don't get paid for at all. Again, an example, obviously, would be parenting or volunteers at a church. They may be doing stuff that's extremely valuable, even economically valuable, like helping somebody's house and putting it back together and painting it and doing stuff that normally would be very valuable, but they're not getting paid for it. And so though it contributes to the well-being of somebody, it's not part of the formal economy, it's part of the informal economy. And in fact, some of the very best things that people do are part of the informal economy. And some of the worst things, obviously, that people do are part of the informal economy, organized crime and the drug trade and sex trafficking and the like. That's all the informal economy. The best of humanity and the worst of human activity often occur under that umbrella of informal economy.